This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. According to U.S. News and World Report, historians describe two waves of feminism in history. The first in the 19th century, growing out of the anti-slavery movement, and the second in the 1960s and 70s. Women have made great strides, particularly since the 70s, but many of those strides have been made outside the glare of media attention that came with the movement in the 70s or even during the fight for women's suffrage. Until now. The Women's March on Washington on the day after Inauguration Day attracted well over 200,000 people, and they were augmented by tens of thousands of marchers in other cities around the country and around the world. Was this a resurgence of the women's movement or a new movement itself? Will these marches make a difference? What's next? We talk about that this hour with three women who participated in the marches around the country and with Kathy Spiller, Executive Director of the Feminist Majority Foundation and Executive Director of Ms. Magazine. It's very early in the morning where she is in California. Thank you for getting up so early and joining us. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure.
Also with us in our Spirit Square studio is Kelly Finley, senior lecturer in the Women's and Gender Studies program at UNC Charlotte. She's also with Girls Rock Charlotte and attended the Women's March in Charlotte. Welcome back to the program, I should say.
Good morning.
Jan Anderson is a retired engineer and Charlottean who attended the Women's March in Washington, in fact, organized a bus, and she's not letting go. She's organizing another one as well. Welcome to the program. And Gail Chauncey is a local banker, another Charlottean who marched in Washington last month. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
Kathy, let me talk with you. What is your take on what happened last month? What exactly, because this in a way felt organic with an urgency to it.
Well, you're absolutely right. Let me start by adding to your numbers. By our calculations, and we've gathered information with the assistance of professors across the country in the Women's March on Washington, there were probably close to 5 million people on January 21st across the United States who participated in one of the marches. And there were, by our last count, over 725 different marches just within the United States. And that doesn't count marches all over the world, literally on all seven continents. This was the largest single day of demonstrations in really, by our numbers, world history. And it just showed the coming together of women and men all across the United States, but led by women, to oppose the agenda of this administration. You know, 54% of women did not vote for Mr. Trump and do not support his agenda across the board on so many issues. And that's what you saw on January 21st, was this incredible outpouring of a message that we won't go back, that we'll fight for equality and social justice, that we're not going to be denied our full role in our society. And that's what you saw happening in extraordinary numbers on January 21st. And I do think that the social media, the modern communications, had a big, big impact in reaching people.
I was going to ask that question because social media seems to have this major influence on a lot of things because it's organic. It just bubbles up from the ground and then it impacts everybody who has a Twitter on their phone, Twitter account on their phone. Would this movement be farther along, do you think, that if social media had been around in the 60s and 70s?
Well, probably so, because we would have been able to reach more. But, you know, this movement has always innovated and leveraged its ability to reach people. The movement has always been very much person-to-person, mobilizing in small communities and big cities, coming together in living rooms and coffee shops. And it's been a struggle always to reach as many people as possible. And I do think that, you know, social media has made it possible to reach people instantaneously. You don't have to wait for phone banking and phone trees to activate or for direct mail to be delivered. And that is just showing how adaptable this movement has been over time. And yet our core objectives have really never changed. It has always been to to stop sex discrimination, race discrimination, discrimination against the poor, to really look at how we can advance the status of women and girls and, as a result, all of society.
Where was this movement prior to the election? It seems to me that it reacted to the election, and a lot of people were surprised by the outcome of the election, and maybe we shouldn't have been, but I think most people were. I think even Donald Trump was. I'll put him in the we. I think he was surprised by the outcome of the election. But if his policies and his attitudes are seen as so onerous, where was this movement prior to the November election?
Well, this movement was in voting booths and walking precincts and staffing phone booths, phone banks, really as never before. Let's not forget, Hillary Clinton won 54% of women's votes. Donald Trump only garnered 42% of women. His victory was among men. He got 53% of men's votes, and he got those votes, 107,000 votes across three states, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan, is what delivered the presidency to Mr. Trump. Had it not been for very small margins in those states, Hillary Clinton would be president, having won more than 3 million more votes than Trump nationwide. So it's a peculiarity, really an antiquity of our electoral system. A lot of people are questioning it. But he did not have the support of women for the very reasons that you saw women come out in such huge numbers on January 21st. He has not only expressed his sexism and racism and in so many different ways, but he's been opposed to pay equality. He's been opposed to early childhood development and child care programs. He's been opposed to tougher laws against sexual harassment and discrimination. So this is what you saw on January 21st was not only the result of shocking results of this election, but a real determination on the part of women to say, we will not go back.
But women, particularly white women, voted for Donald Trump. They did not vote for Hillary.
Well, white women split their votes between Hillary and Donald Trump. That is what also was obviously a factor in this election. But what elected Trump was men's votes. You can't look at the numbers any other way and say that that wasn't the major factor delivering the White House. We've got to do better at getting out our vote across the board. Voter suppression played a huge role in a state like Wisconsin. African Americans in Milwaukee were denied the right to vote in many cases. North Carolina, huge voter suppression efforts throughout the state in the early voting locations that were closed down. So there were a number of factors, but overwhelmingly, when you look at these election results, you see a gender gap that was unprecedented, meaning more women than men voted against Mr. Trump, and that, again, is what was fueling the January 21st.
Yeah, these three traditionally Democratic bulwarks, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, all voted for Donald Trump, and I'm curious, in the aftermath of that and the day after inauguration, what was the participation like in cities in those states for this women's march movement?
Oh, there were marches and gosh, I don't know. I've lost count how many marches in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. Huge marches in small towns and big cities. Now, of course, the closer you were to Washington, D.C., that's where people headed because they wanted to make the most powerful statement. But there were marches literally in nursing homes, in people's homes. They held gatherings in their neighborhoods if they can't get to something larger. There were two marches in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and a march in Erie, Pennsylvania. So it literally was everywhere. this outpouring of not only support for moving forward, but to say that, you know, we're just not going to be pushed back.
So let me talk to Kelly Finley, Jan Anderson, and Gail Chauncey, who are all sitting around the table here in this studio, all of whom participated in marches either in Washington or here in Charlotte. What was, if you had to explain to somebody who was on the moon in January, what moved you to participate? What moved you, for instance, to organize this bus, Jan, to Washington, D.C.? What moved you, Gail, to get on a bus and go to Washington? What moved you to march here in Charlotte, Kelly? What would it be? What was the reason?
Well, I think what motivated me more than anything was the failure of leadership that I saw about to happen, that as a woman, having worked for 40 years in the man's world in engineering firms, we had made tremendous progress. We were going in the right direction. I was anticipating Hillary as our next president, which would have broken another barrier for us. And then I wake up the next day and discover that all of this is wrong, and the person in the leadership position is making statements that are going to take us back 50 years about women and women's place in our society. So as I learned 50 years ago when we were marching on Washington back then, voices matter. And if we all gathered and showed what we need for leadership, mm-hmm. then that would be a first step in the movement going forward. Also, with the lack of leadership that we anticipate going forward, each individual voice is more important to make sure that we go in the right direction. That's why I marched, and that's why we're meeting tonight as well to continue our work to make sure that we get something out of this.
Gail Chauncey.
Oh, thanks. I think for me, marching was sort of a reaction, like everyone else, to what happened. I said this before, and I'll stick to my guns on this. A lot of us probably wouldn't be here if Donald Trump had not won. I think we do like to say, and I do believe that this is more than Donald Trump, but he was definitely the impetus to what we are doing, and it was a pretty strong one. But I think for me, if I can talk about one situation and one issue that sort of drove me to saying I'm getting actually I went in my car, my Mini Cooper, getting my Mini Cooper with my best friend and my friend in solidarity, Jennifer. It was a story my sister told me about Planned Parenthood, and when they talked about defunding Planned Parenthood. I know a lot of us were talking about, reproductive rights and choices. But my sister mentioned to me, as someone who worked in healthcare for a long time, that Planned Parenthood just isn't about reproductive rights. For a lot of women who could not afford healthcare over the years, this was their only healthcare. And for some women who probably may not be able to still afford healthcare, this is their only healthcare. So when you talk about taking women back, mm-hmm. this is taking women way back. So this is one of the many issues that that just sort of fueled my desire to go and to make my voice heard.
Kelly Finley, let me add something. I want to hear from why you did this too. But let me ask this question: would it have been as shocking? Do you think that there would have been as many women participating in this had the loss been Joe Biden's loss and not Hillary Clinton's loss, in spite of a Donald Trump victory? Was it equally dramatic because a woman lost this election?
That's difficult to answer. I think the people who participated in the march are far more sophisticated on the platform that was unfortunately voted in January, and it had nothing to do necessarily with the gender of the opposing platform. It's, we know the legislation that's coming through that's going to cause a lot of, rollback rights, hopefully not, but it looks poised to do so. So it was about the platform, not the person.
I'll come back and get your response to the original question, which was why did you march in the first place, but we have to take a break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute, part of Carolina's healthcare system, offering comprehensive heart care, including the region's only minimally invasive heart bypass option and heart transplant center. and AEG Live, presenting The Piano Guys at Ovens Auditorium February 22nd, an evening of original blends of classical music with pop that began with four dads on the Internet. Tickets and information at Ticketmaster.com. President Trump has ordered a review of Dodd-Frank, the legislation that established new oversight and regulations for Wall Street and the big banks, and there are many in Congress who would like to see major changes as well. We're going to get North Carolina Congressman Robert Pittenger's take on financial regulation in general and Dodd-Frank in particular, and then we hear from the Center for Responsible Lending. They have a different point of view on this program tomorrow at 9.
Two like-minded cities are hoping to bring better jobs to their economies by partnering up. Any guesses?
Berlin's passion and scrappiness is something that we feel is so important to us here in Brooklyn as well.
I'm Kai Rizdal, a startup exchange across the sea, next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30, following All Things Considered, on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking about the women's movement. We're talking specifically about the March on Washington, and is this just a continuation of a long-time women's movement, or is this something new that's going on here with Kathy Spiller, who is executive director of the Feminist Majority Foundation and of Ms. Magazine, Kelly Finley, senior lecturer at UNC Charlotte, Jan Anderson, a retired engineer, and Gail Chauncey, a banker, all three of whom, our guests in our studio, participated in marches either in Washington or Charlotte. And Kelly, you were one of the participants here in Charlotte. Let me ask you what I asked the other women. Why? What provoked you?
Well, I was a feminist before the march, and I'll be one till my last breath. But in particular, in regards to why I didn't leave my hometown and go up to D.C., although I really wanted to, is I lead a youth organization. And so one of the things that I was aware of is the fear, concern, and anxiety in a lot of our youth, our girls, our youth of color, our LGBTQ youth, when they see, and they're well aware of this past campaign, of the comments that have been made, and they just don't know and they just don't understand, you know, what could happen, and they were fearful. So it's interesting because I led, we are with a great group of youth, and, you know, one march creates an entire generation of activists. And they were emboldened and I think encouraged that we as families and parents and leaders in our community are not going to stand by and watch their rights be rolled back and that we would fight and protect for them. And so by the end of the march here in Charlotte, the smiles on their faces, the sense of power and bravery in them all was just so encouraging, lots of high fives. And I know that they will remember that forever.
This actually began, the women's movement began long before the suffragist movement, although that was a big part of it, I suppose. But it gained momentum in America when the abolitionists evidently were locked out of a meeting in London to talk about slavery. In the 1960s, the National Organization of Women was founded because women were locked out of jobs, despite the fact that the Equal Employment Opportunity Act guaranteed them jobs, but they didn't enforce the ban on sex discrimination outlined in the Civil Rights Act. Donald Trump's campaign didn't really talk about women's issues so much as just stand on the platform that the Republican Party constructed, although you did point out some of the things that he's not in favor of, but he didn't talk about that all that much. But you feel then that Donald Trump wants to lock women out again? Is that what this is all about?
It's more than that. It's the whole attitude towards women. The fact that he doesn't seem to respect women, that we are not people of equal value in his society, that really harms women down to the basic element.
And that's based on comments that he made on the Billy Bush bus or Access Hollywood tape and other things or what?
Everything he does belittles women.
And I think, too, and Kathy could probably speak even better to this, to the depth of it's not just the person and the president in this case. It's his entire cabinet that he is appointing, the people who are informing him and have his ear. even if he doesn't outright say, I'm going to roll back rights on women, it's look what's getting ready and what's queued up in D.C. And I'm sure Kathy can just give us a top five list of some of the things that are coming our way.
What about that top five list, Kathy?
Well, there's no question about it. And probably it's the top 20. But, you know, he said during the campaign that women who have abortion should be punished. He is working to see Roe versus Wade overturned. The man that he has put forward, Neil Gorsuch, for the Supreme Court seat, is an originalist, and under that philosophy, women really are not in the Constitution. The Equal Rights Amendment was not finally ratified, and so under the philosophy of Neil Gorsuch, women don't have standing in the Constitution other than our right to vote, secured by the 19th Amendment. Mr. Trump has said that he doesn't want the tougher enforcement of laws against sex discrimination in the workplace. His early appointments now are looking to close the or substantially decrease the Violence Against Women office in the Department of Justice. The education secretary that he's put forward, Betsy DeVos, is devoted to the Republican platform, which is to close down the enforcement of Title IX, the equal education law that has opened up opportunities for women and girls and education in this country. They no longer want it to be enforced as it pertains to sexual harassment and sexual assault on college campuses and in high schools. So stop me when I decide. But and he was very clear about this, as were the Republican the platform. Very clear about where it stands on women's full equality. And that came across repeatedly during the debates and in the whole election. And in addition, his own record on women. You know, he brags about how many women he's put into power, but look at his, as Kelly said, look at his nominations for all of his cabinet positions. It's mostly older white men. Virtually no women, and only one, or two, I guess, people of color, one woman and one man. So, this guy is absolutely doing everything that we feared he would do, and that's why the reaction on January 21st was
so big. All of the things you listed must add up to the reason you've said that this election has shown the urgent need for an equal rights amendment in the Constitution, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Why has that been so? Why has that been so difficult to get done, do you suppose?
Well, For two quick reasons, and then those from North Carolina may be able to add even more insight, because North Carolina is one of the unratified states. But from the time the Equal Rights Amendment was finally voted out of Congress in 1972, by the way, it was introduced for the first time in 1920. So 1972 finally voted out to go to the states. Congress, in its wisdom, the 98% men who control both the Senate and the House, put a time limitation on the number of years that would be open for states to vote to ratify. And in that time period, 35 states voted to ratify out of the 38 that you need. The major opponents to the Equal Rights Amendment have always been, and to this day, the Chambers of Commerce, the Manufacturers Association of America, the insurance industry. Those were the three major opponents. And why? Because we still, women, 79 cents on the dollar, and we believe that's too generous a figure when you take a look at all the underemployed and part-time women who want full-time employment. And insurance pricing has always overcharged women for the same package of insurance that men have always been able to secure. And insurance pricing has been discriminatory. So there are real economic opponents to women's full equality. And yet among the general public, both women and men, the Equal Rights Amendment enjoys overwhelming majority support. So it's the still male-dominated state legislatures, driven by these economic interests, beholden to these economic interests, that have always opposed full equality.
And with that, I have to let you go, because I know you have to leave at this point in time to go to another appointment. Kathy Spiller is Executive Director of the Feminist Majority Foundation and of Ms. Magazine. Thank you for joining us so early in the morning in California. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and good luck to all of us, especially North Carolina.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Let me continue with Kelly Finley, Jan Anderson, and Gail Chauncey. She just listed all of these things, and I want to talk about this for a second because I have a list of key dates for women throughout the history of the United States. I want to share some of these. I didn't know many of these. 1777, the year after we passed our All Men Are Created Equal Declaration of Independence, all states in America, or all colonies, I guess, passed laws to take away a woman's right to vote. That's 1777. 1866, the 14th Amendment is passed by Congress, with citizens and voters defined as male in the Constitution. 1873, the Supreme Court rules that a state has the right to exclude a married woman from practicing law. 1769, it was decided that women could not own property in their own name or keep their own earnings. And that started to change only in 1839 when Mississippi granted women's rights to hold property with her husband's permission. It wasn't until 1900 that every state had passed legislation granting married women the right to keep their own wages and to own property in their own name. And then there's this long struggle to get the vote, the unsuccessful drive to get an Equal Rights Amendment passed. It might be considered understandable, I think, all these things in the 18th or the 19th century. We thought differently back then. Maybe even in the early 20th century, the resistance to all of this might have been understandable. But it continues to this day. How do you explain that? Seriously, we've had women CEOs now. We have women in Congress. We have women on the Supreme Court. We have women in state legislatures. We have female governors. How do you explain this?
Is it to the lack of the ERA? How do we explain the lack of
any
the
of
ERA?
It? This resistance to equality.
It's men in the legislature.
They are
we
most
all
of those men are married.
There, okay, back in the 60s, okay, the problem was women didn't have a voice because we had well-meaning husbands and fathers and sons and brothers who all said, we'll speak up for you and mm-hmm. we'll do what is right. Mm-hmm. Well, the perspective is different from the women's side. And we've learned over these 50 years that that's only got us so far. Now we need to speak up for ourselves. Women need to speak up for ourselves to make sure that our voices heard correctly. And I guess the biggest example is birth control. If men could have babies, we'd have birth control in the water. There'd be no question about it, and yet we're still arguing that fight mm-hmm. because it's a woman's issue. That's what I think is the problem.
Yeah. I agree, and I've talked to a lot of people about this sort of phenomenon of why are men so sort of sticking their heels into this. And the best thing that I can come up with is the power. And the one thing that Kathy said about the legislature, I think this is where a lot of us are going to have to realize this is where we're going to have to make the changes. We talk a lot about because Jan said, it's the legislators, the men who are running, our government, who are making the policies, who are creating the policies and bringing them down to the states and then stopping them at the states, like this particular act that you talked about that was only ratified by 35 of the 38 states it needed. But I think that's where our fight needs to change. We need to realize that, again, this is about Trump, but also about the fact that we need to get more granular in getting more people in these positions of power to make those changes.
And I'm a little fuzzy on this, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that one of the key opponents to the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment was Phyllis Schlafly, wasn't it?
That's correct.
A woman. And mm-hmm. many women joined on that train.
Some did. I mean, she represented a small but very vocal minority of white, women, I would say socially conservative, and, some of them Southern women who misinterpreted and misrepresented what the ERA and the effect that it would have. And
was that deliberate or was it out of ignorance?
Probably a little bit of both. When you exploit someone's fear and someone's lack of information of how the government works, how the law works, you can see all types of ripple effects, and I think we're seeing it yet again, that some of the promises that were made in this past campaign are completely impossible to have happen out of the president's office. And so, it's interesting that small minority voices also can be quite powerful against progressive movements and vice versa, and you've seen that all throughout history.
In January, Susan Rose, writing for womensenews.org, said the American women's movement in organizing for a battle over Donald Trump's conservative agenda. She talked about this was an organization against the conservative agenda of Donald Trump. So is this a women's movement or a progressive liberal backlash to the resurgence of conservatism?
I think the march itself was the women's march, but if you look at on DC and then it took global. But if you look at the leadership involved in the march, it went across genders, across race, across immigrant status. What is so encouraging is we have learned the lesson of history. At least I hope that many people involved have, that we cannot schism. And divide amongst ourselves and pick and choose our issues if it only affects you as a white woman, if it only affects you as a citizen of the United States, that we all must stand together and work together. So by definition, that would be a progressive platform, but it was under the umbrella in this case that it was the Women's March. But if you look at it, it's a very sophisticated platform that the Women's March represented, just issues for women.
But isn't there a natural schism there? Because I ask the question, can you be a conservative woman or a conservative man and have participated in these marches and subscribe to your philosophy and what you think needs to be done?
Yes, you can. Because women's issues are human issues.
Right.
So they're across the board. We represent all points of view. It's just that it helps to have more than one point of view. You know, as a white male, you have a lot to contribute to society. But as a white woman, I also have a lot to contribute. And as a person of color, you have a lot to contribute. We all have different perspectives on life. And when they're not, the other perspectives aren't being heard, then things get garbled. They're not quite.
But there are a lot of conservative women who voted for Donald Trump, and a lot of conservative women who would subscribe to the Republican Party platform, which got him elected, or on which he ran, let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
How can they have feet in both of those camps?
Okay, let me give you an example. Okay, for this meeting tonight, I've been getting a lot of emails. I got one from a friend who I know is a Right to Life person. She was emailing me about the Affordable Care Act and wanted to make sure that I got my group to write and call to support the Affordable Care Act, common ground, even though I'm pro-choice. So we find the common ground. We're not trying to divide. We're trying to find the common ground and move it forward.
You've been involved in organizing a letter-writing campaign to save the Affordable Care Act and to oppose Betsy DeVos, who's the president's nominee for the Secretary of Education. Why are they women's issues? Because of the access to health care that women will not get without the Affordable Care Act? And why is Betsy DeVos a women's issue? Because they have children in schools? I'm just asking.
Because moving our country forward and having good policy on all spectrum benefits everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if we see an issue and we think things are going in the wrong direction, for instance, the Secretary of Education, the irony of it is the women's movement is opposing a woman. Because she is not the kind of woman that we want in that position. She's not qualified. We want qualified people for positions. And education is important for our families and for our society.
Well, with that, we'll leave it for that until we come back from the break. That is Jan Anderson, a retired engineer in Charlotte who went to the Women's March, organized a bus to go to the Women's March on Washington. Gail Chauncey is here, a banker, and Kelly Finley with UNC Charlotte. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mille Lacs Jewelers, direct diamond importers at the Arboretum, dedicated to consumer protection, ethical business practices, and gemological knowledge. Information about financing options available at MilleLacsJewelers.com. And Blumenthal Performing Arts, presenting Fiesta Flamenca, a performance of flamenco, a multicultural art form, demonstrating its power to build bridges between cultures, February 16th through 18th at the Booth Playhouse. Tickets at BlumenthalArts.org. Well, the big banks never liked Dodd-Frank and the regulations that followed the 2008 financial crash. President Trump says he's going to do a big number on those laws. How can he balance that with his populist campaign message? Who's being protected, Wall Street or Main Street? That's the topic of the conversation on Point, coming up with Tom Ashbrook in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can get to us at charlottetalks at WFAE.org, through Facebook, or Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We are coming right back.
You can celebrate WFAE, the season of love, and all things chocolate, Thursday, February 9th at Spirit Square. Guests will enjoy handcrafted chocolates, chocolate desserts, and other chocolate-inspired items, sweet and savory, from area chocolatiers, bakeries, breweries, and others. Proceeds from this decadent event will benefit WFAE. Learn more and register at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Women's March on Washington as part of an ongoing timeline of the women's movement with Kelly Finley, senior lecturer at UNC Charlotte, and with Girls Rock Charlotte. She marched in Charlotte. Jan Anderson is a retired engineer, and Gail Chauncey is a banker. Both participated in the Women's March on Washington. Which of the key issues in your minds to women have broad support among both liberal and conservative women? And is that a good place to start to find common ground?
I think common ground is always it's going to be the only place we can start. The thing about what I think the march told me was that we were a little divided. I think you used the word schism. Mm-hmm. And we had, even though we acted as if we were all on the same page, we really had our own agendas, or at least we thought we did, until we came together and we realized the intersection of a lot of these issues. And so there's a lot of common ground. One of them is what Jan talked about, is, the Affordable Care Act. I've talked to and read about many people who are conservative, who probably voted for Trump, who are concerned about this, the health care. And it becomes not an issue of, progressive or, liberal, it becomes an issue of what we need as a society, as a social issue almost. And I think, so there are a lot of things, there's a lot of common ground. I think this is where this movement is going to get its momentum, is when we tease out all of these issues that really don't matter, and when I say don't matter, when they're not going to change, they're not the issues that are going to really help us get what we want, what we need in society. But these really important issues like choice and LGBT and pay is another good one. There were a lot of people who voted for Donald Trump because they felt like they didn't have the jobs that they felt like they needed access to. That's not a black issue. That's not a white issue. That is an issue across the board. That's the common ground.
As you said, the 5 million women who participated in this probably came to these marches with 5 million different reasons and found in the aggregate, I would think, a tremendous amount of power. Just the fact that 5 million people came together for the same reason energized you beyond. It's astronomical, it would seem to me. But you mentioned LGBT rights a second ago, Gail, and people came together for Planned Parenthood. They came together for LGBT rights. They came together because Black Lives Matter, part of that movement too. All these different diverse ideas and concepts that really have tangential association with the women's movement. Mm-hmm. How does that work with all these different things coming together? How do you achieve all of that and your major goal?
Well, I mean, to the point of, like, for example, Black Lives Matter, three women, young women, started Black Lives Matter. So, as to Gail's point, that's the intersection. of the women's movement, well, those women of Black Lives Matter are women. And so you see the intersection of race and gender, class, and so forth. You could look at, you know, people who come to the march because, you know, they identify as woman, but they also identify as lesbian. You can't be, you know, the famous saying is you can't be an Asian on Monday, a woman on Tuesday, and son, you know, or daughter of immigrants on Wednesday. You are all these things at all time. And so that's what I mean by we have learned the lessons of history. That it is, you know, discrimination against some is just discrimination against all of us, and the only way to undo that is to liberate all of us.
Well, you've said that intersecting oppressions require intersecting liberation. You cannot end sexism if you do not fight to also end racism.
Yeah,
a lot of people might have a difficult time understanding that. They see those as discreetly different things.
I wouldn't. I mean, if you are a woman of you know, color, or even a white woman, I would hope that you would see that what causes the hatred and discrimination that causes sexism is the same, and the greed for power is the same that empowers racism.
If you're right about all these white guys in legislatures making these decisions for women and holding this movement back and holding the equality of women back, what can you say to them? Because this is all motivated. But if you're right, it has to be motivated out of fear, and the fear is loss of power. Mm-hmm. What can you say to them to ameliorate that fear, to remove that fear in some way?
Well, my experience on the job with men, and I'm the only woman in the room, is they're all well-meaning. They all are good people. But the perspective is different from the other side. So I don't
explain that. Can you? I mean, it may be difficult because
I don't want you deciding on which doctor I go to or what kind of health care I get. I wanted to make those decisions myself. That's the most obvious one. But the other one is just, and I tease my husband. I say, you know, you don't want me choosing your golf clubs, and I don't want you making choices for me. Mm-hmm. I'm an adult. I can make my own decisions. And I think from our perspective, and one of the big things that's going to come of this movement, is women now are ready to step forward and say, I'm going to take my place in the legislature, in the active world, and speak up here so my voice is heard, and that will take care of 90% of what we're talking about.
Let's talk about that, because I think it was January 21st, those marches, because it was the day after Inauguration Day. And that they made the headlines, and they stole the headlines from the president's previous day, no question about it. Assess the impact of that day and what happened that day. And is this – one of you referred to this as a beginning. It's a starting point.
Yes.
So how do you take that energy that was there that day, which is now almost, what, 3 weeks away?
3 weeks.
How do you take that and harness that energy and move forward?
Okay, I'll tell you what I know about what's happening now. First of all, on the bus ride back from D.C., I had a captive audience, so we all decided what we were going to do next. Mm-hmm. We're forming an organization. It's basically for networking, setting up an email list to get information out about activities in town that we can participate in and lend our voices to. Mm. We're meeting tonight to have our first organizational meeting. We have 8 topics of interest that are just the obvious ones, but anyone who wants can also add other topics, such as women's health, LGBT, legislation, get out the vote, racial issues, immigration. So we're starting. It isn't a women's thing. It's just getting women to let their voices be heard, to speak up for ourselves, which is, I think, where we are now.
Become a political force.
And
it's
then,
not just about women's issues. It's about women becoming politically
political force. Yeah. Yes. Yes. And I think a big goal is to run women for office, local, state, federal. Mm-hmm. The more women we have of all races and color and creed and whatever, the more diversity we'll have and the more likely we'll have all perspectives represented.
Is this happening around the country, or were you just particularly enlightened here in Charlotte?
Oh, example? It's around the country. It's amazing. I mean, we're a grassroots organization, but there are two or three other groups that I'm already aware of. One of them, Indivisible, which is a national group that's all online, that women are meeting and starting to do things. And I think it'll coalesce into two or three larger groups eventually, and we will become forces. I mean, there's already Emily's List and Lillian's List that are running candidates, and I think after Trump was elected, the phones were ringing off the hook about women and wanting to know how they could get involved.
You're an engineer, and Gail, you're a banker, so you both know that numbers matter. And particularly the size. The bigger the number, the more, I guess, impressive, or the more voices are heard, because, my God, 5 million people. You can't ignore 5 million people and the 5 million voices that they have. But that's one day. Mm-hmm. So how do you get those 5 million voices to coalesce to be there all the time and to be this political force? Is it important that they be together, or does it have to happen at the city council, county commission level, where it's a smaller number of people?
No, and that's kind of my platform. Jan talked about on the way back, they kind of all got together and figured out what they wanted to do. Jen and I did the same thing. It's like, what do I want to do? How do I feel like I can use my talents, you know, and my passion for this whole movement to the best of my ability, you know, to make the most change? And one of the things that I feel very strongly about is voting. This movement shows that we are bigger than any of us thought we were. I think we all sort of felt isolated, and now we know how big we are. I think the thing that we have to understand is that we have to turn this passion into voting power. This is the way the country is built. We may not like it. We may not like to talk about voting and getting out and doing the grassroots stuff, mm-hmm. but it was votes that got us here, and it will be votes that will get us out.
Is this not unlike, could this be not unlike the Tea Party movement, which has had a substantial impact on politics and Washington? I mean, could this 5 million voices that came together become a different kind of Tea Party?
I mean, yes, and I think it's also important to point out that women have had, a great influence politically for the past several decades when it comes to elections. And, you know, Kathy talked about, you know, taking a critical look at the numbers. But women aren't just getting started. We've been doing this for quite a number of years and number of decades, exercising our power and knowing our power. I think what is happening, and especially if you look at it with a historical lens, is with the advantages of technology and media, multiple social movements are merging together to work together. Mm-hmm. And so when and that gets to be quite powerful. And so we had a visual representation of that this past January. But here forward, we're going to see that happen over and over again. And so, you ask, what do we do here forward? It would be, one, yes, pick the issue that's important to you, voting, you know, getting involved in running for office. But I would also encourage people to pick the issue in which you don't have a dog in the fight. Because, you know, if you identify as, you know, cisgender or straight or as white, then a citizen of the United States, pick an issue that that you ally across, because that's how we're also going to stick together and make progress. We cannot do the same thing we've been doing for the past few centuries, which is thinking, well, if it's not my rights, it doesn't matter. That's another reason how we got here, is that there was apathy. There was, a sense, well, somebody else will do it for me. And, you know, you don't know what you got till it's gone. I think we're going to see that coming in 2020, which will be the 100th anniversary of suffrage for women and the 50th anniversary for the Women's March in New York City that started and really galvanized the second wave of feminism. So I can completely geek out on the history of it, but I think we're on to something here.
I do. And it's funny, Kelly, because I have a story about a coworker. We had lunch, and you know, she's supportive of the women's movement, heavily supported. She's from a Middle Eastern country, and you remember when we had the riots and things here with the shooting? She naturally wanted to go out and march. She's kind of a radical, and she kind of jumped up and she said, in her office. I think I'm going to go out and do this. And her colleague said, why are you going to do that? And she said she sort of let those folks, make her sit down. And then she's from a Middle Eastern country, and then the ban comes. And all of a sudden, she's in the fight. Now she has a dog in the fight. Mm-hmm. And she was very humbled by that. She was pretty apologetic to me. And I said, I knew that she was supported Black Lives Matter. That action, she could have had a report to do. I don't know. But the point is that she was very moved by that, by the fact that you're right. If we don't have a dog in the fight now, I love that saying, that we probably will. And we have to realize, again, that these issues are – we're not just Black women, we're not just engineers. So
let me flip it around. 5 million people is a lot of people. And that's the estimate that Kathy Spiller gave out in terms of people around the country who came to these marches, men and women who came to these marches in various cities around the country. A lot of people. But there are several hundred million people in the United States. So there's a lot of people who did not go to those marches. A lot of people, men and women, did not vote for Hillary Clinton. They voted for Donald Trump. And a lot of women and some men voted for Donald Trump while holding their nose because of some of the things that he said about women and other people and other things, because they wanted him to achieve what he's trying to achieve right now. So why didn't more women – would it have made a difference if Hillary Clinton broke that glass ceiling? And why wasn't that more important to more people that happen, given some of the things that Donald Trump said that caused people to vote for him while holding their nose, if that makes any sense?
Mm-hmm. It's a good question. I think there are people who vote for platforms and there are people who vote for personality politics. And, it's kind of difficult in this past election to parse out which was which. I do think there are people who held their nose and were voting for a platform. And then I think there were people who were either voting for a personality or voting against, gender or change or something. And so it has been an interesting and I think the jury's still out. We are still, mm-hmm. The dust is still settling. And I think it would be a really interesting question to ask a year or two from now, those same supporters, how do they feel about their decision now?
Because the election was a catalyst for action. And then what happened on that day after Inauguration Day was an enormously energizing event. The trick now is to keep that energy flowing.
Absolutely. It's not romantic stuff, but this is where you roll up your sleeves and you get to work.
Kelly Finley is senior lecturer at UNC Charlotte and also with Girls Rock Charlotte, participated in the Charlotte March with some of those girls, I would think.
Yes.
Jan Anderson, a retired engineer, organized a bus to Washington for the march. Gail Chauncey, a banker, marched on Washington as well. And earlier in the conversation, we talked to Kathy Spiller, executive director of the Feminist Majority Foundation and Ms. Magazine. Thank you all for the hour.